Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Vice President Mike Pence is in South Korea now after visiting the DMZ. North Korea attempted a missile launch over the weekend. You might know that failed. Pence's visit follows U.S. actions in Afghanistan and Syria over the past 2 weeks, and that's where we start our weekly conversation with Ken Rudin. Hello, Ken.
Good morning, Beth.
So we have a shift in military action that has been dramatic when you look back at President Obama's administration. Are you tracking what has been a wide range of reactions to this?
Well, nobody seems to know whether it will work or what we're trying to do with the Kim regime in North Korea. But it's also clear to say that nothing has worked so far. I guess, you know, administrations going back, you know, Democrats and Republicans have tried the carrot and stick approach to Kim. Nothing seems to work. And if you listen to what Vice President Pence has said, what National Security Advisor Henry McMaster has said, H.R. McMaster, and Donald Trump's tweets themselves, it's more, certainly more stick than carrot. But again, we'll see if anything works.
So just to hear a little bit of what you just referenced, first of all, the Lieutenant General McMaster said on ABC News, while it's unclear and we do not want to telegraph in any way how we'll respond to certain incidents, it's clear that the president is determined not to allow this kind of capability to threaten the U.S. And then this morning, we do have a bit of sound from the vice president.
Just in the past 2 weeks, the world witnessed the strength and resolve of our new president in actions taken in Syria and Afghanistan. North Korea would do well not to test his resolve or the strength of the armed forces of the United States in this region. We will continue to deploy the THAAD missile defense system as a defensive measure called for by the alliance and for the alliance. We will continue to evolve a comprehensive set of capabilities to ensure the security of South Korea. And as our Secretary of Defense made clear here in South Korea not long ago, we will defeat any attack and we will meet any use of conventional or nuclear weapons with an overwhelming and effective response. Over the past 18 months, North Korea has conducted 2 unlawful nuclear tests and an unprecedented number of ballistic missile tests, even conducting a failed missile launch as I traveled here for this visit. The era of strategic patience is over.
Strategic patience is an interesting phrase, but I thought we should listen to him, Ken, because just the fact that he's there and speaking is a loud statement to the world, don't you think?
It does. I mean, I know the whole world is listening, and I know the whole world listened and heard the bombs on the missile attack, the ballistic missile attack in Syria, and that gigantic bomb that was dropped in Afghanistan. The question is whether Kim heard it, and that's a good question, because I can't imagine anybody threatening. I don't think anybody could call his bluff. In other words, I don't think he's threatened I don't think Kim is worried or frightened or anything that the Washington will say. He's always been a loose cannon, a maverick, and the fact that we're talking about everything is on the table, and we're talking about nuclear weapons. We'll respond with nuclear weapons if necessary. It just seems like, I mean, we could be talking about the end of the world here, and we're talking about language that we haven't heard. We probably haven't heard anything since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 62, and even then, both Kennedy and Khrushchev tried to tamp down fears and made a point of not letting it escalate into World War III. There seems to be more, I don't think it's not a countlessness, but a more of a sense that the language is more incendiary than it should be.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to with you, is the bigger picture of how dramatically the American reaction has changed. We're not even in the first 100th day of the Trump administration, and already we have this dramatic shift. 9/11 forced this shift from President Clinton to President Bush, but what other presidencies have done such a turn militaristically?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I remember, but President John F. Kennedy, when he was campaigning for the presidency in 1960, he talked about a missile gap and how the Republicans let our defenses down. Now, that clearly was not true, and he may have even been telling a falsehood, but it seemed clear that Kennedy was far more aggressive, talking far more aggressively about foreign policy than the outgoing Eisenhower administration. I mean, Nixon certainly was more hawkish than President Johnson when Nixon took over in 69, but Nixon did talk about pursuing peace with honor, so there really wasn't a dramatic change there. And I guess you could say that, you know, Ronald Reagan was going to be more aggressive in foreign policy than Jimmy Carter, who was criticized for not being aggressive at all.
Right.
But I don't think I could think of a time like this when a president, you know, comes to power and, or when he's campaigning for president, says, "I'm going to bomb the S out of ISIS." I mean, the such casual nature of foreign policy and foreign policy actions does concern, should concern a world that is stockpiled with nuclear weaponry.
Well, the way we're communicating, too, you have this official visit by the vice president, and then you have the president tweeting. And one of his tweets in terms of China and mentioning that China is working with us on the North Korea problem, and he's looking at China differently now. So we're actually watching what's happening unfold on a couple formats, should we say? Platforms?
Really? China's no longer a currency manipulator? I didn't know that disappeared. But here's the thing, though. I mean, it is a complicated world. And I think that's the point I'm trying to get at here. When Trump talks about bombing the S out of ISIS and saying, well, China could, you know, could hold back North Korea. Well, when Trump met with the president of China, he said, you know what? It's not so easy. And I think it's one thing to have bombastic language on the campaign trail. Once you take office, you realize it is not that easy. And Trump is slowly learning that, but that hasn't tamped back, though, the kind of rhetoric you're hearing from his administration and from the tweets.
It might be a good point to add in one other interesting thing that's happening domestically, and that is that Bernie Sanders is going back out on the road. He's going to take his campaign now across the country, and his campaign is aimed at limiting the president to one term.
Well, it's two things. One, it's aimed at making sure that Donald Trump is a one-term president, but it's also putting a little pressure on the Democratic Party that they need to be more aggressive. You know, there are a bunch of Democrats in the Senate who represent red states, Trump states, and say, well, I don't know if it's best for my political future to be, you know, opposing Trump and his nominees at every turn. But Bernie Sanders and the progressive wing of the party said, look, let me give you a perfect example. Last week in Kansas, which historically is a Republican state, a Republican district, Trump won it like with like 60 plus percentage points. And the Democrats put no money into that special election last week in Wichita for the race for the seat that Mike Pompeo gave up to become CIA director. Anyway, the Democrat finished within 7 points of the Republican winner. And many Democrats are saying if the Democratic Party lifted a finger, put in some money, put in some boots on the ground, as we saw with, for example, with Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012 in his victory, if they exerted some kind of effort, almost akin to what Harry Dean said years ago about a 50-state strategy, they could have won that seat. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but clearly there are a lot of people like Harry Dean, like other progressives, who said that the Democratic Party still needs its tush, you know, kicked in now and then to remind them that there are seats that are winnable, and but you can't win unless you bring in the money and the manpower.
You're listening to the political junkie, Ken Rudin. He joins us every week on Insight. That means we should bring up an election happening tomorrow in Georgia's 6th congressional district and what might happen there.
Well, this is, by the way, I want to let the record show that it's the first time I ever said tush on your program.
You know, I was going to go there, Ken, and I thought you would just let it go. And
I'm incapable of doing that. But anyway, tomorrow's election in Georgia, this is the one that Newt Gingrich used to hold. It's the one that Republicans have held since 1979. It's a vacant district because Tom Price became HHS secretary. And here's the thing. Mitt Romney won this district by with like 67% in 2012. Donald Trump won it by a point and a half
in
2016.
Close. Right.
So there's anti-Trump feelings. There are demographic changes going on in the district. And there's the Republicans are eating their own. There were 18 candidates in the race. 11 of them are Republicans. There's really one Democrat, a guy named John Ossoff, first-time candidate who's raised $8.3 million.
Wow.
And the Democrats are uniting behind him. The Republicans are beating each other up, running ads against each other. But if Ossoff wins, all 18 candidates are on the same ballot tomorrow. If somebody, like, for example, Ossoff gets 50%, he is elected, and that would be send shockwaves around the country. But even if he doesn't win, even if he doesn't get 50%, he's likely to be the front runner for the June runoff. The Republicans have to decide whether they can fight their ideological impulses to beat each other up and unite behind whoever finishes second tomorrow, or there are a serious risk of losing that seat. And if the Democrats can win that seat in Georgia, more and more Democrats are saying, well, you know something, maybe the control of Congress, control of the House in 2018 is doable.
All right, we'll check in about that one next week. Meanwhile, I do want to talk about the fact that these tax marches were held across the country this weekend, some of them out of the country. In fact, they attracted protesters, the anti-Trump people, and people who were rallying, or I don't know if you should say protesting in favor of Donald Trump, but the main message is for Donald Trump to release his tax forms. And he tweeted about that, too. So let's cover just a little bit of that. There were 21 people arrested in Berkeley and at least 11 people injured, Ken.
Well, you know, he says, I want to find out who's paying for these rallies. And nobody cares about the fact that I haven't released my tax returns because I won. The election's over and I won. It's interesting that when it comes to people protesting about his failure to release his tax returns, he'll say the election is over. But any opportunity he has to talk about Hillary Clinton, he'll talk about lying Hillary as if the campaign were still going on. But the fact is that every president since the 1970s, I mean, I've said this over and over again, has released his tax returns. Donald Trump has used the audit as an excuse. People think it's just an excuse. We don't know, you know, what about his tax returns by not disclosing the logs of who visits the White House. We don't know who's doing that as well. So there are a lot of questions about business connections and otherwise that the American people are just not learning. And Donald Trump could say all he wants over and over again that the election is over, but people are demanding answers. And perhaps these rallies are one way of showing it.
Outside of tradition and that reasoning that it's always been this way, why is it important and how important do you think it is that he release his tax forms?
Well, the fact is, you know, people who run for office in the past running for the Senate, for governor, for Congress, have always released tax returns. Donald Trump, being a businessman with no political experience, has never had to release it because it was private information. And given the fact that Trump Industries still has a global presence around the world, and given the fact that his son-in-law and daughter, Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, are still ostensibly doing business with Trump Industries in addition to Trump's sons, one wonders if there are actions taken by the administration that could benefit him and his family and his organization.
And so, that's what it's about, is what is the conflict of interest here, and would those tax forms prove it or show it?
One would think so, yes, absolutely.
Well, I think I'm going to wrap this up, but with one other note, and that is besides the fact that the National Egg Hunt happened this morning at the White House, there is news apparently that the First Lady and the First Family son, Barron, will actually move to the White House. Did you see this?
I did. I mean, the line has always been the fact that the Barron Trump needs to finish the year of school. And at the end of this semester, the First Lady and Barron Trump would move back to the White House. That doesn't mean that the president will take every advantage he can to vacation in Florida, but at least the back and forth to New York seems to be going by the wayside.
Oh, yeah. I think most everybody expects that we'll continue those trips to Florida.
Yeah.
All right, Ken. It's a Monday. Take care. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'll never say that word again until next week.
You just avoided it. I'm proud of you. That is Ken Rudin, the political junkie. You can find a link to his website at capradio.org/insight. And you're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio.